lot of electronic stuff here to figure out. May 23rd, going to the woods retreat, Dharma talk, the hindrances and spiritual maturity. In order to be happy, the Buddha said that there are three things that we need to do. The first is do no harm. The second one is act for the good. And the third is to purify the mind. So at the beginning of the retreat, we took the precepts in the spirit of do no harm. It's the very most basic thing we need to do in order to be happy. Not just because harm hurts others, because it hurts us as well when we do harm. So it's twofold. And then naturally following from not doing harm is act for the good. It's really a natural consequence of not doing harm. So cultivating wholesome qualities like generosity, compassion, kindness, gratitude really helps us to bring a sense of connection with others, and it helps us to recognize our own goodness as well. And the third, of course, is to purify the mind. And when we talk about purifying something, we're not talking about getting rid of anything. And that's really important. It's not that we have to get rid of anything. By purifying something, we're really bringing out the good in it. We're bringing out the best. We're seeing it in its own goodness. And so in our lives, over time, you know, things develop. We develop habits. I think you're all seeing that here on the retreat, that there's certain patterns of thought going on. And often these are mixed messages that we get from our culture and our society, messages that are very confusing about what can make us happy. So they end up causing us suffering because they get internalized. And so that's what we're talking about, purifying. Some of these messages can make us kind of lose touch with what will truly bring joy and fulfillment in our lives. And often this sort of return to our own truth, our coming home, our return to authenticity that we all seek. This is the subject worldwide for millennia of many legends and myths are about this return to our own goodness. So this is really part of the human condition, this purification. So tonight what I'd like to do is talk about those places where we're likely to get stuck. And in this practice, we call these places the hindrances. And the Buddha said that there are five such areas where we're likely to get stuck. And everything that you can think of can fit into one of these five. So these are the five hindrances, and they are greed or the wanting mind, aversion, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and worry, and persistent doubt. Those are the five. One of my first teachers on this path was a man named Shinzen Young, wonderful teacher. He's still out there teaching. And he used to refer to this practice as becoming a super adult, right? Not like Superman, but what he meant by this was that it was beyond what we ordinarily think of as adult maturity. It was like the final, shall we say, the final frontier of becoming a super adult. And by this, what he meant was that as we grow up, we become socialized by our society, by our parents. We learn to show restraint. If we're upset, We don't lie down on the floor and throw a tantrum. We might feel like it, but we don't lie down on the floor and throw a tantrum. If we want something that somebody else has, we don't bop them over the head and take their candy bar. You know, we don't go shove somebody like we did on the playground. So if we're angry, we learn not to act aggressively. So we learn to control our wants and needs. We learn not to go crazy with our credit cards. But we start to understand, as we're sitting here, as we're doing this practice, that just controlling our anger doesn't necessarily make it go away. Or just controlling what we do with our credit cards doesn't really stop us from wanting more and more, from wanting things that we really don't need. You know, if wanting and having things could make us happy, this would be the happiest country in the world, wouldn't it? Because everything that we want, we reach for and it's there. And all we see around us is massive unhappiness. So what this practice will do is actually uproot some of the tendencies and some of the identifications that are underlying some of these mind states like ill will and anger and greed. So it takes us beyond just regular maturity to super adulthood, because it starts to really go beyond the cosmetic fix, beyond just the showing of restraint in our lives. It actually takes us to the real root of the cause of our suffering and unhappiness, and allows us to really start getting underneath there and getting to some of these things. The wonderful Zen teacher Suzuki Roshi pointed this out in this quote. He said, "Pulling out the weeds, we give nourishment to the plant. We pull out the weeds and we bury them near the plant to give it nourishment. So even though you have some difficulty in your practice, even though you have some waves while sitting, those waves will help you. You should not be bothered by your mind. You should rather be grateful for the weeds, because eventually they will enrich your practice. If you have some experience of how the weeds in your mind change into mental nourishment, your practice will make remarkable progress. You will feel the progress. You will feel how the weeds change to self-nourishment." So what is it exactly that's being uprooted and purified? What it is our identification with some of these unwholesome states. The problem is not the anger or the wanting. Those things come and go. We've already seen that. They come and go on our own. We're not really in control of that. But what we can work with is how we relate to them. We can start to change our relationship to the way that we identify these things, instead of, "I'm angry, I'm greedy," just simply that there's greed or anger present. I can move this down a little bit. Why don't I do that? Are you getting too much feedback? No? Is it okay? So the waves will come and go on their own. But what really breaks the power of this identification is mindfulness. Just sitting here and being able to, without judgment, experience some of these things helps to break the identification that we have. To look them in the eye. That's what mindfulness really is. To look it in the eye and say, "There's anger," or "There's that mind lost in fantasies." So this really simple process of being present to whatever is arising begins to loosen this negative hold that these mind states have over us. And this is the real strength of mindfulness. And this may seem kind of counterintuitive, you know, that we have to go more deeply into something in order to get through it, in order to get past it. But that's exactly what mindfulness does. By actually going into something more deeply and getting to know it and investigating it starts to be the way out of the hold that whatever this mind state has over you. So this is a little bit like maybe sitting down and talking to a friend who you've had some difficulties with. The more the two of you are really able to face things, be honest with each other, go into them, and talk them through, the easier it is to get through the difficulties. And this is kind of what we're doing with mindfulness. So it's not that these waves don't keep coming. It's just that eventually there's nothing for it to stick to because we've broken our relationship to it. We've broken our sense of identification. It's a little bit like this. A couple weeks ago, I spilled something at home in kind of a new, nice new white porcelain sink, something that should have just created a horrible stain. And I went, oh, it's my new sink. And so I got a rag and I wiped it up. And to my amazement, there was no stain there at all. So this is what starts to happen in our practice. There's nothing for it to stick to. Because we start to break some of the identification that we have simply by looking at these mind states and acknowledging them. And at first in our practice, our minds are all over the place. You know, we talked about this in one of our group meetings. We talked about one of the first real insights that people have when they sit down to meditate is that our minds are all over the place. They're not very disciplined. And there's a name for that, and it's called monkey mind. See that monkey up there? Sitting up there? Did anybody wonder what that was doing there? It's right over there on the end. That's to remind us, you know, that that this is one of the first things we become aware of. Actually, I have a little cartoon here. I'm sort of copying Peter and passing cartoons around. But I said to him at dinner, I said, I'm in your lineage of cartoon passers.
Make sure not to
pass your nose with it. There's one on the other side too, so yeah, make sure that you do the one that one. There you go. Okay. So unless we and this is why we start with the breath, unless we really start to train our minds to focus, to do these mental trainings, we can't really begin to see what's going on. Is that on? Sorry. We can't really begin to see what's going on. So there's a lot of trial and error in this. You know, we don't just sit down and get it right the first time. We really have to work with these things and see what works for us. And keep working with it. And once the mind has settled down, sometimes there's some kind of unpleasant stuff that starts to kind of gurgle up from underneath the surface. And our first reaction to this may be, well, I was sitting here and I was just totally blissed out and I was so calm and I'm so relaxed. I must have done something wrong, right? I made this happen. I made this mind state come up. I made this ill will come up. I made this story about how somebody humiliated me come up. That's not the case at all. As a matter of fact, you didn't do anything wrong. One of the things that happens as the mind settles is some of these things that are kind of underlying, that are often driving us without us knowing it, start to kind of come up to the surface, so we can start taking a look at them. And this may not feel so good, but it's a real blessing that we're able to sit here in this really beautiful, safe environment and be with some of these things. There couldn't be a better place to be doing this. So this is the process that's at work in our practice. So chances are, it's one of these five, as a matter of fact, it is one of these five things. Or sometimes we can have what we is often referred to in jargon as a multiple hindrance attack. Where you get them all. Has anybody had that happen yet on the retreat? Where it just, you get them all at once. You know, wanting, greed, sleepiness, restlessness, doubt, all of them, all at once. And these are called hindrances because they are hindrances to having a clear mind. They're always going to color our perceptions of things. We're not going to be able to see clearly when we're caught in the grip of a hindrance. And they come and go on their own. And so this word hindrance might kind of give us the idea that these are things we're supposed to be getting rid of. But they're not, because we really don't have any power over whether they come and go. So learning to be with them can be thought more of opportunities to get to know our own mind. And they are really marvelous opportunities. They may not feel that way. They may not feel like they're much fun sometimes. But they are opportunities to really see what's at work in our minds. So the teachings give some suggestions about how to work with these impediments, we might say, to a clear mind, or these impediments to mindfulness. The moment that a hindrance arises, by definition, we're not mindful. That's why that hindrance can arise, because we're not mindful. But something happens, something really cosmic shift happens when we actually bring mindfulness to that hindrance. It's no longer just a hindrance. It's now mindfulness of wanting, mindfulness of ill will, mindfulness of anger, mindfulness of doubt, mindfulness of sleepiness. So in the next instant, when we realize that happens, that is a moment of mindfulness. So the first way of working with these is to simply note it. Oh, there's anger. There's restlessness. Fell asleep. Just woke up. Head's bobbing. Can't stay awake. So no evaluation is really needed. So that is the first strategy for working with a hindrance. Just simply note it. And this is what we've been talking about for the last 2 days. To just simply name what's happening without trying to go into a big story about it. Just say it. Look it in the face. The second way of working with these is to actually focus your attention on the hindrance and to observe it with mindfulness. So it's a matter then of investigation and getting to know it. Mindfulness, no matter how strong the hindrance is, mindfulness will always help to settle the mind. Actually looking at it and investigating it will help the mind to settle down. It'll bring some stability and help us get through whatever the upheaval is of the hindrances. So getting to know it, making friends with it, I could almost say making friends with a hindrance. getting to know what triggers it. What is it that kicked that off? Is it a thought? Did we have a thought that started the hindrance rolling, started the story rolling? Did we see something? Did we hear something that reminded us of something that started this whole chain reaction? What's the quality of energy in the body when a hindrance is happening? You know, because they're in our minds, but they're in our bodies too. It's a very energetic reaction that we're having. It's a whole mind-body reaction. So what's the quality of the energy? Is there any tightness in the jaw? Are the hands clenching? Is there heat in the body? Is it pleasant? Is there pleasant tingling? Is there warmth, softness? Does the mind take off in a fantasy every time the hindrance arises? If there's pain in the body, do we start using thought like a drug, you know, getting on this, rearranging our living room every time there's some pain, you know? Oh, I think I'll put the couch over here and put the TV over here. And we all do that. But notice when that arises. Notice if there was some pain right before that, something that we really didn't want to be with. And the third suggestion in working with the hindrances is to switch to an antidote. So what an antidote is, it's a practice that will counteract a particular mind state or a particular hindrance. And we've been doing metta here. Last night Peter did metta. I will do a guided metta tonight. Every night we're going to do a guided metta. That would be an example of an antidote. An antidote to ill will, an antidote to self-judgment. Because it allows the mind to expand away from the narrowness of the focus of the hindrance. And I'll talk about a couple others as well besides metta, but metta is just an excellent antidote to a lot of the hindrances. So the first of the five hindrances to clarity of mind is greed or wanting. And sometimes this hindrance is compared to not being able to see your reflection in a pond. You know, we have ponds out here. So it's not being able to see your reflection because somebody's gone out there and thrown all this brightly colored dye on it. And instead of looking at our reflection, we get really distracted by all these kind of colored baubles and dyes floating around the water. So it's this distraction from being able to focus. So wanting or greed is not, and I really want to emphasize this, it's not about our capacity for pleasure in life. It's not about our capacity for enjoying things. It's simply about getting caught up in the delusion of what can make us happy. Getting out of focus, not being able to see our reflection, because there's all these other things that we get fixated on. I mean, this is really what the wanting mind does, doesn't it? It gets really fixated on something that we want, and we lose all perspective. We get fixated on an object that we think is going to make us happy. And the mind is really slippery around this. I mean, wanting is really, really interesting. I sometimes do this workshop where I talk about these three temperaments of, because people do kind of tend towards one or the other. Not totally, but some people tend more towards wanting, some people tend more towards aversion, and some people tend more towards being delusive. And at the end of the workshops, we usually break up into groups and I say, okay, now everybody who thinks they're a wanting type, go over here. And everybody who thinks they're a delusive type, go over here. And everybody who thinks they're aversive type, go over here, and you can kind of commiserate and congratulate and do all those kind of things. And it's so interesting to me, hardly anybody ever goes into the wanting group. And that's because it is such a slippery mind state. It's really hard to recognize because we totally convince ourselves that we need this thing, whatever it is. This is not wanting. I really need this. No, this is different this time, right? The mind always convinces itself that it needs this object, and it's really good at creating strategies on how to get it. I mean, people who tend towards this are really kind of good at kind of lining things up, you know? Very interesting to travel with somebody like this. They walk into the hotel room, and before you know it, you know, they've got the best view, they've got the best bed, they've got their clothes hung up in the best place in the closet, you know, and you're kind of standing there like, how did they figure all this out? Well, because it's really a habit of mind to strategize to get what we want. Or sometimes there's this sense of, we just won't be complete until we have that thing that we want. Right? It's like part of us is missing. Sometimes this is referred to as the if-only mind. If only I had this, I'd be happy. If only I had that. If only I was in a yurt instead of a casita, I'd have a better meditation, right? If only that had been a chai latte this morning and not just chai, my sitting would have been so much better. If only I had a different partner, if only I had more money, if only I had a better job, if only my kids did better in school, I would be so much happier, right? So it's often, watch for that in your mind, that not necessarily in those words, but in that sort of attitude, this if-only attitude. Because underneath that, I can assure you, there's wanting going on. But the odd thing about all this is that once we get this object of desire, what happens? We lose interest. A friend of mine said to me recently, her 7-year-old son said to her, he said, "You know, Mom, you want something, and you want it, and you want it, and you want it. And then you want it even more, and then you get it. Then you don't want it. Life is really weird, isn't it, Mom?" So wanting is not about the object. Because if it were, when we got the object, we would never want anything else. But that's not what happens. You know, we go and we take a nice helping of food, and halfway through eating that, our minds are already on the next one. Shall I go back for seconds? You know, I wonder if there's any left. So this is really important to know that wanting is about wanting. It's about, can I say, a minor addiction? You know, it has manifestations in serious addiction. But it's sort of a minor addiction to that feeling tone of wanting something. So this is the wanting mind. One of the first retreats I did was at the Lama Foundation, just north of Taos here in New Mexico. And the two teachers who were teaching that were Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, who have been teachers for many of the teachers in this country, and both Peter and I have studied with them. And as they sat down, and Joseph was going to give a Dharma talk on the hindrances, there was a lot of kind of good-natured poking and joking going back and forth between he and Sharon about how if he started with wanting, he would never get to the other hindrances. And I was amazed. As he started talking about the wanting mind, I had this feeling that he would never get to the other four, that he was so interested in that mind state. I had a feeling that he could have spoken about it for hours because he was really so interested in how the wanting mind works. And that is kind of number two of the strategies that I said about how to work with these, is to really get to know it, to really get interested in it, to see how it operates, to see how we react, to see how we act, to see what goes on in the mind. You know, and as I heard him going on and on, as a new meditator, I thought, what is with this guy? You know? I thought we were supposed to be getting rid of all that stuff, and he's going on and on and on. But this intense interest is really what will help us to see these hindrances as opportunities for wisdom. So he was focusing his mind really on the process of the wanting mind and getting to know what it felt like in the body. So this sense of interest in what's going on in our minds and bodies is really what brings energy and alertness to our practice. Can you imagine how much more alert you are when you're really interested in something? We see this in our daily lives all the time. When we get interested in something, you know, we can stay up all night trying to figure something out or research something. Who hasn't, you know, gotten into clicking around on their computer, right? And pretty soon it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So that's the kind of interest that brings alertness to our practice. The next of these hindrances to clarity that the Buddha talked about is aversion. And aversion can have a huge range of manifestations. It can show itself as anything in its extreme form, from hatred to anger, ill will, jealousy, resentment, irritability, and even to fear. And I want to just say this as an aside too. When we're working with the hindrances of the wanting mind and with aversion, you know, let's make no mistake, these are really powerful forces. This is not a minor thing that we are doing here. If you look at any situation in the world that's not going so well, I can guarantee you that one of those forces will be behind it. It's really what's driving the world. So this is really very important work that we're doing. But what all of these states, like jealousy, resentment, hatred, anger, ill will, fear, what they all have in common is that they are experienced as a contraction in the mind and body. You know, feeling anger is not exactly a light and cheery feeling, is it? It's heavy. It's painful. It's a real contraction. And when I say contraction, it's also a mental contraction because it doesn't allow us to see the whole picture. We get just focused in on one little thing. For instance, fear as a manifestation of aversion. What is fear? Fear, first of all, fear is always about the future. It is never about what's happening in the present moment. And secondly, it's about really narrowing up those possibilities for the future. We start a story about the worst possible scenario that we can imagine. So it's a narrowing of all the possibilities of an outcome of a situation. So that's really what aversion is. That's exactly what hatred is. It's only seeing what's wrong with someone. It's not seeing the whole picture. So what happens is memories arise and they make us angry, or we're sitting here and we're we're burning with fury and indignation over something that somebody has said to us. We may not like the food. We may not like the person sitting next to us. We think of how someone last week humiliated us. So these are all manifestations of aversion. And it's so easy to just say, oh, I think I'd rather think about something pleasant. This is really not very much fun to think about. But here's where these suggestions for working with these really come in handy. First of all, just noting it. Irritability, anger, hatred, negative thoughts. Just naming it. Irritation. So just noting it, simply naming it without pushing it away and without feeding it. I mean, we feed all of these things. We create so much drama in our lives, don't we? We create these stories that are just so dramatic. And they're not very interesting. You know, if you've sat here with some of these stories and if somebody else were to tune in on what's going on in your head, I don't think it would be the stuff of a Hollywood movie. So the other suggestion was getting to know it. What does it feel like in the body? Is there discomfort? Is there heat? Often when I'm angry, I start to notice that there's just all this tightness around my eye socket. You know, my jaws are just, you're sitting here and your jaws are clenched. And you realize I'm angry. So this is the process of understanding these states, that they're not fixed and solid. The process of anger is really heat, tightness in the jaw, clenched fists, storyline. This is the process. And it's a changing, unfolding process of being with these things and investigating them. So aversion can be a really strong habit of mine. I feel like I'm doing a Joseph. I happen to be an aversive type, so I could go on and on and on about aversion. I'm gonna try to kind of control it a little bit. There was a meditation manual written in the 6th century. And one of the, it's a huge compendium called The Path of Purification or the Visuddhimagga. And one of the things that's in here, in it, is really kind of interesting. It talks about what kind of a meditation hut and what kind of environment each one of these types should have. The greedy type, you know, what is most conducive to helping them towards realization and freedom and helping them understand their minds. So this is what it says, that somebody who tends to be aversive, this is what their meditation hut should be and what their surroundings should be. It says, the meditation hut should be pleasant and well-proportioned, with frieze work and lattice work, brightened with various paintings, and a soft, smooth floor adorned with flowers, and a canopy of many-colored cloth like a Brahma god's palace, a bed and a chair adorned with pretty covers, smelling of flowers set about in homey comfort. The right kind of garments for the ascetic should be those of silk and fine linen and cotton, pure of color, to befit an ascetic. The meditator should walk on alms rounds where people come out to meet him and serve him food carefully prepared with their own hands. The people of the village are agreeable, handsome, and well-bathed. The food is fine gruel and rice that is inviting and nutritious. It really makes you want to be an aversive type, doesn't it? It sounds like they're kind of getting off easy. You know, shouldn't Shouldn't they be suffering a little more for being so aversive? Why did they get all this homey comfort and a palace, like a Brahma god's palace? So what happens when somebody who is aversive is put into this very wonderful environment with all these people serving them these wonderful things and these silk robes? What happens is that here's an environment that is so pleasant that there's really nothing to nitpick about, is there? I always think it's kind of like being at Phi Cetus. What's not to like? It's so beautiful here, right? Well, a couple of really interesting things happen when somebody like this is put in a perfect environment. Because this is such a strong tendency of mind, eventually they will definitely find something to nitpick about. They'll find something that they don't like, even in the most wonderful of environments. So that's why they're put in that environment. Because pretty soon there will be nitpicking and fault-finding and fear and ill will, however the aversion is manifesting. So eventually, what hopefully they can see is that the aversion is not in the external world. It is an internal thing that's going on. Because here's this wonderful environment, what's not to like? And their mind is still doing this. So they can start to understand that the aversion is not about the object. It's about what's going on in their own mind. It doesn't originate outside. It's an internal disposition. And whenever it sees an object that it perceives as unpleasant, it attaches to that. I don't like it. And I don't mean by this to say that there aren't things in the world that are wrong. I mean, there's a lot wrong in the world, and there's a lot wrong with other people, and there's a lot wrong in ourselves, too. But because it is an internal disposition, it will immediately attach onto things that it doesn't need to attach onto and start to feel ill will or anger or irritation or just generally be bugged about something. So it's helpful to really depersonalize these states, to just simply say, you know, there's wanting arising, there's anger arising, there's ill will arising, there's self-judgment arising. Because they are impersonal. As Peter was talking about earlier, we can't make them come and we can't make them leave. Would we want this in this moment? Would we really want to feel some of the things that we feel? Probably not. So we're really not in control of them in this moment. So again, it's the mindfulness that helps us really look this in the eye and break the identification. And the third suggestion that I had to work with these was to apply an antidote. So an antidote would be a practice that really strengthens the opposite qualities from what we're experiencing. For example, anger. It's never a good idea to repress anger. And it's probably not a good idea to express anger in the heat of the moment. So the antidote to anger is patience, to just be able to stop, like with the stop exercise, to just be able to stop and give ourselves some space until some skillful way to express what we're feeling comes up. The antidote to ill will is loving kindness. If we're feeling ill will towards someone, to do metta for them, to do the loving kindness practice for them. If we're feeling a lot of self-judgment towards ourselves, to do metta for ourselves, because we're really the ones who are suffering in this moment. And I would invite you, anytime during the retreat, anytime during a sitting, when it really gets to be overwhelming, to switch to metta. Because it is a perfect antidote to this kind of narrowing of our possibilities. It helps to open up. Metta was originally taught by the Buddha as an antidote to fear. So if strong fear that's so strong that we can't investigate it in that moment, just simply turn to metta, because it will help to calm the mind. So the next two hindrances that the Buddha talked about are what I might refer to as energetic states. The first is dullness and drowsiness. I don't think anybody here has experienced that so far in this week. I'll talk about it anyhow, even though I know you haven't experienced. So you know what it is when it comes up, right? Sometimes it's called by this these wonderful words that I love, sloth and torpor. It sounds so 19th century. It feels like a British costume drama, doesn't it? Sloth and torpor. Dullness and drowsiness. Sometimes we just can't stay awake, right? We try, but our heads keep bobbing up and down. So what to do? What to do when this happens? Well, first of all, to acknowledge what is happening and to know that it's involuntary. It's not some moral failing if you can't stay awake, you know? It's just an involuntary, energetic state. There's a couple very practical things that we can do around dullness and drowsiness. One is to be more vigorous in our walking outside, you know, to really kind of rouse our energy, to walk faster, to not be too comfortable, you know. If you're wrapped in a blanket, maybe don't wrap yourself in a blanket and sit in the room where it's not so warm, where it's a little bit colder. Open your eyes. Stand up. It's very hard to fall asleep when you're standing up, as some of you, I think, have noticed already. And then there's some also great things in the text that I love, like pull on your earlobes. Now, somebody told me that there's actually a little acupuncture point in there, that it really, you know, has some effect. Another one is a practice of imagining very bright light, you know, imagining bright daylight, or opening your eyes and really looking out into the light. You know, our lives are so busy that we just never stop. And then we come on retreat, and our poor bodies are so confused. They say, the only time we stop is when we're going to go to sleep, right? So our bodies get very confused. They're not used to just sitting down and doing nothing. So they say, it must be time to go to sleep, since that's the only time we ever stop. So if you fall asleep, notice when you fall asleep. Notice what it feels like. It's very interesting, you know. There starts to be this kind of sinking in the body. The eyelids feel like lead. There are very strong sensations accompanying falling asleep. And then just notice when you wake up. Just woke up. Just note it. So here we are, and so we need to let our bodies know that it's okay to just sit down and do nothing but be alert. That's all we have to do, is just be alert and mindful. Henry David Thoreau, in his book Walden, wrote about this. He said he would often sit on his porch for hours just listening and looking at the sun as it moved from horizon to horizon. He said, "There are times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work. Sometimes in a summer morning, I sat in my doorway from sunrise till noon while the birds sang or flitted noiselessly through my house. Instead of singing like the birds, I silently smiled at my incessant good fortune." So what incessant good fortune do we have to be able to just sit here and be alert? And sometimes, rather than having too little energy, we can have too much energy. And this is the next of the five hindrances, called restlessness and worry. We can feel agitated and anxious. We can sit here and feel like if we have to sit for another minute, we're going to jump out of our skins, that we just can't stand it. When I first started sitting, the same teacher, Shinzen Young, I had a lot of agitation and a lot of restlessness. And I went into him and I said that I just feel like my skin's crawling. I just can't stand this another minute. And he looked at me and he said, "It's okay. I've never heard of it lasting more than 5 years." And it did. Not consistently, but in my practice, almost 5 years to the date. So again, this is involuntary. And you may feel very comforted to know that this is the last hindrance to go before total enlightenment. So if you're feeling this, know that you're really in solidarity with almost every other meditator in the world, that they are experiencing this too, and that they can't make it go away. So as with drowsiness, there are some very practical things that you can do. You can sit more comfortably. I don't mean slouching, but just sitting comfortably, being warm enough, kind of wrapping yourself up in a blanket, walk at a comfortable place, and try to work with the sensations in your body. Often it's very difficult because these are sometimes very strong sensations, these sensations of agitation and restlessness. And simply just use the breath to try to calm the mind and body, to try to work with the restlessness. And the very last and fifth of these impediments to mindfulness is persistent uncertainty or doubt. And this word persistent is really the important word here. Because when we first start a practice, especially a spiritual practice, it's really good to doubt things. It's good to not swallow it whole. It's good to really check it out and see if this is what we really want to do. In fact, the Buddha actually told his students to do this. He said, "Come and see for yourself. Don't even take my word for it. Check it out and see what's true." And that's a really important underlying teaching in this practice. This is not a belief system. This is experientially finding out what brings happiness in our lives. We're not asked to believe any dogmas in this practice. So the kind of doubt that we're talking about is persistent doubt. It's that feeling of just kind of standing there at a crossroads and feeling so much indecision that we can't figure out which way to go. And this can be really painful and debilitating to feel this kind of doubt. I really have great compassion for people who suffer from this. Or it can kind of be like being in a relationship and the entire time we're in the relationship wondering if we should be in the relationship, instead of just being there and trying it out and seeing if it works. And there can be lots of doubts that come up. There can be doubts about our own abilities, doubts about our self-worth, doubts about others, doubts about your practice, doubts about the teachings. And this kind of doubt can really drain our energy, this kind of painful indecision. And it's often very difficult to see, to name as doubt, because it always seems so logical, right? Our mind is telling us something so logical. You can't do this. this is not important. You're not good enough. It always seems logical. But doubt and uncertainty are really part of life. You know, we can't avoid this in life. So much of life is unknowable. We can't really know what's going to happen. But one thing that we do know, and that is if there is persistent doubt, we are not being with the breath. Just for a doubt to arise is one thing, but if it just keeps hanging on and hanging on, we are not in the present moment. So the antidote, really, for doubt is mindfulness. To simply crank up the mindfulness. You know, you really have the rest of your life to wonder if this was the best way to spend these 6 days, right? And I hope that's going to be 50, 60, 70 years. Can you imagine when you're 80, sitting there going, back in 2013, I spent those 6 days at that meditation retreat. I wonder if I should have maybe been on a bicycle trip in Glacier National Park instead. I doubt it. So you have the rest of your life to really figure that out. But while you're here, just try it out. I mean, what do you have to lose? To just be present and being with mindfulness and being with our experience. So it's through exploring these hindrances and learning to be with them that we start to learn wisdom. We can become very wise by exploring these hindrances. And you might say that all of what I've said tonight can be summed up with this old saying that many of you have probably heard, and that is, where the rub is where the pearl grows. Really, in investigating where the difficulties are is where we become wise. So I'd just like to close with this quote from one of my favorite poets that may be really obvious by now, Mary Oliver. She says, "What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I have gone out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another." So let's just sit together for a few minutes and then we'll have a walking period. Everything is nourishment, somehow or another.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.